Imagine being handed the keys to one of the fastest aircraft in the world and told to rip out every gun, strip the armor, fill the wing bays with cameras, and then paint it pink, and then fly it, alone over Nazi Germany. That was the job of a photo reconnaissance unit pilot in the Royal Air Force during the Second World War, and today on ATIS, I'm Tower, and we're going into one of the quieter corners of World War II aviation history. Not a dogfight story, not a bombing raid. This is about the aircraft that never fired a shot in anger and yet arguably shaped the outcome of the war as much as any fighter group could. The story of the Prue Spitfires, the pink ones specifically. Today's aviation news is brought to you by AviationSold.com, aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSold.com. Let's go back to 1939. Britain is on the edge of war, and military planners know they have a problem. They need eyes. Not ground intelligence, not radio intercepts, photographs, hard, verifiable, undeniable photographic evidence of what the Germans are building, where they're building it, and how fast. The aircraft doing that job at the time were modified bombers. Bristol Blenheims, mostly they were slow, they were large, they flew at relatively low altitudes, which made the photography better but made the aircraft a sitting target. Crews were being lost, and worse, the intelligence they were bringing back was patchy. The Luftwaffe would simply wait until the weather was bad, move assets around, and the Blenheims couldn't keep up either literally or operationally. An RAF officer and accounts differ on exactly who articulated it first. Put it plainly, the bomber approach to photo reconnaissance was not working. What was needed was something fast enough that it didn't need guns. Something that could be over the target and gone before an interceptor could get to altitude. Something that climbed like a rocket, flew high, and looked like nothing the enemy could catch on a good day. The answer was already in service. It just had to be reimagined. The Supermarine Spitfire had entered RAF service in 1938. By the time the war started, it was widely understood to be among the finest fighter aircraft in the world. The elliptical wing gave it exceptional high-altitude handling. The Merlin engine was a thoroughbred. And it was fast, very fast for its era. But the man who really drove the conversion of the Spitfire into a reconnaissance platform wasn't a regular RAF officer. He was an Australian businessman and aviation enthusiast named Frederick Sidney Cotton. Cotton had spent years before the war running unofficial photographic missions across Europe, often under cover of business travel or civilian flight operations. He had an almost instinctive feel for what worked in aerial photography and what didn't. He'd already been running covert recon flights in a Lockheed 12A before the shooting started, sometimes with German officers as passengers who had no idea the aircraft was bristling with hidden cameras. When war came, Cotton was brought officially into the RAF fold, given a commission, and tasked with building what would eventually become the Photo Reconnaissance Unit, or PRU. He was unconventional. He drove his superiors to distraction, and he was usually right. His first modification principle was simplicity itself. Take everything off that isn't needed. The guns add weight, the armor adds weight, the radio equipment, strip it down to essentials. Every pound you save is more fuel or more altitude. An altitude Cotton understood was survival. The early Prue Spitfires, converted from the Mark I airframe, later from the Mark IV, had their armament bays sealed over. Extra fuel was plumbed into the leading edges of the wings, turning the wing structure itself into a fuel tank. Range went from a few hundred miles to well over 1,000 miles, depending on the mark and configuration. The aircraft could now reach Berlin and return from bases in southern England. That was a capability the Blenheims never had. The cameras went in where the guns had been, or into modified bays beneath the fuselage. The standard fit for a high-altitude oblique shot used two cameras mounted to look slightly downward and sideways. The overlap of their coverage gave interpreters the stereoscopic imagery they needed to assess depth, identify structures, and spot camouflage. Cotton's team understood something the early bombers had missed. You didn't just need a photograph, you needed a photograph that an intelligence analyst could actually use. So now you had a fast, light, long-legged aircraft with cameras instead of guns. The next question was, what color do you paint it? And this is where things get interesting. The early Prue Spitfires flew in standard RAF camouflage, brown and green on top, light blue underneath. That made sense for a fighter that would be maneuvering over terrain. It made considerably less sense for an aircraft that was going to be at 30,000 feet or higher alone over the North Sea or Central Europe. Cotton had already been experimenting with a color he called camotint on his pre-war civilian aircraft. It was a pale, slightly warm, duck egg green or blue-gray, depending on the mix. The idea was that at altitude, an aircraft disappears into the background of the sky, and the background of the sky is not blue-gray. It's a complex mix of light scatter, haze, and atmospheric perspective. The underside of an aircraft at altitude caught in sunlight looks quite light, almost white in some conditions. The sides and top against the upper sky need to blend with a pale, washed-out blue. The RAF settled on a color called Prue Blue for most of the fleet. It's a distinctive shade, not the dark blue you might expect, but a soft, medium-tone blue that could read almost turquoise in some lights. If you've ever seen a Prue Spitfire at an air show or in a museum, that's the color you remember. It became the signature look of the unit, but there was another color. And this is the one that tends to stop people when they first learn about it. Pink. Not camouflage pink, not a vague pinkish gray. Actually pink. And for a while, some PRU Spitfires flew operationally in a shade that was officially described as a medium pink, sometimes referred to in contemporary accounts as Mary Rose, or simply as the Prue Special Pink Scheme. How did this happen? It came down to observation and experimentation, which is really how most good aviation thinking happens. Pilots and ground crew noticed that at certain altitudes, particularly around dawn and dusk operations, and in the high-altitude haze over the Atlantic approaches and over northern Europe, a light pinkish tone actually blended with the ambient sky color better than the standard blue. Think about it from a physics standpoint. At very high altitudes, you're above most of the moisture and dust that scatters blue wavelengths near the surface. The sky takes on a different character. At the horizon, even at altitude, there's a warm scattering effect, particularly near the sun angle. An aircraft silhouetted against that horizon, or photographed from below by an interceptor trying to identify it, would be harder to spot if its underside was a pale warm tone rather than a cool blue. The RAF didn't have color spectrometers and atmospheric modeling software. They had pilots who paid attention and ground staff who mixed paint. The pink scheme emerged from that iterative practical process. It wasn't universally adopted. PRU blue remained the dominant color for the unit, but the pink aircraft flew real missions and the color was considered effective enough to keep using. There's something almost poetic about it. Here's this machine built for war, stripped of every weapon, painted in a color that wouldn't have looked out of place on a garden wall, flying alone above Europe while the continent burned. And flying alone is the part that doesn't get enough attention. The Prue pilot's job was fundamentally different from any other flying role in the RAF. Fighter pilots had wingmen, bomber crews had each other. The Prue pilot was solo by necessity, not by choice. A second aircraft would mean twice the visual signature, twice the contrail, twice the fuel burn for no operational benefit. The photographs could only be taken by one aircraft at a time. So you flew alone. You climbed above 30,000 feet, sometimes above 40,000 feet in the later marks, where the temperature outside was 60 degrees below 0 Celsius and the oxygen system was all that stood between you and unconsciousness. Your cockpit was unheated in the early aircraft. Pilots flew in layered clothing, electrically heated suits in the later war, and still reported that the cold was almost unbearable on the longer missions. And you had no guns. This is worth sitting with. If a German fighter found you, if a Focke-Wulf 190 or a Messerschmitt 109 managed to reach your altitude and close to firing range, you had one option. Run. The Prue Spitfire's speed and climb performance were its only defense. The aircraft could generally outrun and outclimb anything the Luftwaffe put up against it, particularly at altitude. But that's not the same as certainty. Pilots were lost. Some failed to return and nobody ever found out why. The standing instruction was simple. If intercepted, do not engage. Divert, climb, accelerate, go home. The cameras and the film they carried were too valuable. The mission mattered more than the engagement. That's a hard mindset to maintain when something is shooting at you. And yet the Prue pilots maintained it, mission after mission. What did they bring back? The intelligence value of Prue operations in World War II is almost impossible to overstate. The Prue Spitfires photographed the Bismarck before she sailed on the mission that would lead to her sinking. They documented the German naval buildup at Kiel and other ports with enough detail that planners could track individual vessels by their shadow angles and mooring positions. The Prue provided the imagery that allowed analysts to identify the V-1 flying bomb launch sites along the French and Belgian coasts. The sites were then bombed in a campaign called Operation Crossbow that historians credit with significantly delaying the German offensive. Before D-Day, Prue Spitfires flew hundreds of missions over the Normandy coast and the entire coastline of northern France to avoid revealing the specific invasion target. The photographs were used to build the detailed terrain models that planners used to brief troops right down to the company level. Every landing site, every pillbox, every gun emplacement that Allied forces knew about going into June 6, 1944. The imagery came from the PRU. The photo interpretation side of the operation was equally remarkable. The RAF established the Central Interpretation Unit at Medmenham in Buckinghamshire, staffed by a mix of military personnel and civilian experts including archaeologists, geographers, architects, people who knew how to read a landscape and identify anomalies. It was at Medmenham that analysts first spotted the large circular earthworks at Peenemünde on the Baltic coast and correctly identified them as a rocket development and test facility. That discovery led directly to the bombing of Peenemünde in August 1943, which set the German V-2 rocket program back by an estimated 6 to 12 months. All of that started with a PRU Spitfire flying alone over the Baltic, taking photographs and coming home. The aircraft themselves evolved throughout the war. The early Mark I conversions gave way to the dedicated Type D long-range variant, then to the PR Mark IV, the PR Mark VII, and eventually the PR Mark XI, which used the Merlin 60 series engine and could reach altitudes approaching 44,000 feet. That was above the operational ceiling of essentially every German interceptor in service. At that altitude, the PRU pilot was genuinely untouchable. The problem was that the aircraft handled very differently that high up, and the cold was extreme, and the pilot had to manage oxygen carefully on missions that could last 4 to 5 hours. By the later years of the war, the PRU had expanded well beyond Spitfires. The de Havilland Mosquito entered PRU service and gave the unit the ability to fly two-man crews, go even faster, and operate at night with specialist equipment. But the Spitfire remained at the core of the unit's identity. The pink paint scheme didn't survive the whole war. By the middle years, PRU blue had become standard for most operations, and the pink aircraft were repainted or retired as older airframes were replaced. The color lives on in historical accounts and in a handful of wartime photographs. There's something striking about seeing a Spitfire in pink against the gray English sky. It doesn't look right, and then you think about what that aircraft was doing and why it was that color, and it starts to make a different kind of sense. The pilots who flew the PRU didn't get the recognition that fighter aces did. There was no score to keep. You couldn't put a kill marking on the side of your aircraft for a successful photo run over Berlin. The measure of success was whether you came back with film, whether the film was usable, and whether the intelligence derived from it led to anything actionable. The feedback loop was long and indirect. There's a parallel to a lot of work that happens in aviation that doesn't make the headlines. The safety inspector who catches a squawk before it becomes an incident. The dispatcher who pulls a flight for weather before the pilot even asks. The controller who sequences a sequence that prevents a conflict nobody else saw coming. The value is in the things that don't happen, and those things are very hard to count. The PRU pilots flew into danger without the ability to fight back, did their job, and flew home. When they couldn't do all three, they usually managed two. The intelligence they brought back shaped the course of the war in ways that are still being documented and analyzed by historians today. Sidney Cotton himself was eventually removed from command. His personality was too abrasive for the RAF bureaucracy, and his unconventional methods caused friction with people who cared more about procedure than results. He spent the later part of the war in a diminished role, watching the unit he had built grow into a major intelligence arm of the Allied Air Forces. He was never fully decorated for what he had accomplished. History has been kinder to his legacy than his superiors were. The Aviationist ran a good deep dive on the Prue Spitfires and the unusual paint schemes. It's worth reading for the technical detail on the camera, fits, and the color experimentation. You can find it at theaviationist.com. More aviation history and current news at radiohangar.com. I'm Tower, fly safe, and keep your cameras loaded.